And today we'll be talking about some of the circumstances leading up to the birth of Jesus Christ, and we'll talk about what really happened in contrast to all of the myths and legends and traditions that have sprung up around Jesus Christ's birth. So I'd like to start out, quick reminder, some important concepts we talked about, how conditions had to be right in that part of the world in that time for the Messiah to be born and for the message of the gospel of the kingdom of God to go out. And we talked about the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, or the peace of Rome that existed around that part of the world and established a level of peace and stability that had not existed there before. We also talked about the appearance of the angel to the priest Zechariah as he is there in the temple, telling this elderly priest that he and his wife Elizabeth would bear a son whom they would name John, and John the Baptizer would be the one who would prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. And then we talked about Gabriel's appearance to young Miriam, a teenage Jewish girl, who told, and Gabriel tells her that she will supernaturally conceive and give birth to the Messiah. And we talked about her visit to her kinswoman, a cousin of relative of some sort. And we talked about the timing of the conception of the pregnancies of Elizabeth and Mary, and how Jesus may well have been born on Feast of Trumpets or first day of the Feast of Tabernacles. So any questions about any of that that we've covered so far? Okay, good. Well, now we'll pick up the story in Luke 2 and verse 1 in your harmony. This is at the beginning of, page 6. Yes, get through the first four pages. I might also mention that obviously we're not going to cover all of the harmony and the level of detail I've been covering so far. So there will be sections where the material is somewhat overlapping or carries on some of the same themes we've covered. So there will be portions of the harmony that we will skip over. But again, I'm setting the stage for you in a lot of this material, covering it in greater detail. So picking up the story in Luke 2 and verse 1. And it came to pass in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. And here's a photograph of a bust of Caesar Augustus, or Augustus Caesar. Rule it reigned from 27 B.C. to A.D. 14 when he is replaced by the Emperor Tiberius at Augustus's death. Caesar Augustus, again, quite a competent administrator. He is the heir, he's the great nephew of the great Julius Caesar, quite a capable administrator, and really the Roman Empire really comes together as a unit under his rulership. So quite a noted emperor and a very good one, especially compared to later ones like Nero, Caligula, some of those who are borderline, if not actually insane, during their reign. So the Roman Empire is ruling over the entire Mediterranean region, including the Holy Land, what we know today as Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, that whole area. The Roman Empire circles the entirety of the Mediterranean Sea. Continuing on, this census first took place while Quirinius was governing Syria. Quirinius is a close friend, actually, of Augustus Caesar and a military advisor to him. So there are these connections there. Quirinius, incidentally, governed in that area two different times, which we don't have time to get into all of that. Continuing in verse 3, so all went to be registered, everyone to his own city. Some people wonder about this, wondering why the Romans would have ordered people to return to their own city, their ancestral homeland, their city of origin, to be registered. And they assume that Luke must be wrong about that. But at least three different documents have been found from the first and second centuries that show that the Romans indeed did order people to be registered by returning to their hometown for a census. I'd like to read from part of one of them that was pertained to Egypt. It was discovered there. And it reads, Gaius Vibius Maximus, prefect of Egypt. Prefect is the same title that Pontius Pilate later holds, so kind of the equivalent of our modern government governor. Orders, seeing that the time has come for the house-to-house census, it is necessary to compel all those who, for any cause whatsoever, are residing outside their districts to return to their own homes, that they may both carry out the regular order of the census and may also diligently attend to the cultivation of their allotments. So we see here that here's a Roman decree from the governor, the prefect, that people would return to their own homes to be registered for the census. And census, I might add, it's not stated in the Gospels, but actually this is registration for tax purposes. The Romans were very keen, as all governments are, on making sure people pay their taxes. So that's an underlying reason for on. As we've also discussed in previous classes, God uses external circumstances to carry out his plan. We talked about earlier how God used some of the conditions of the Roman Empire, namely, again, the Pax Romana, the Roman road system, the Greek language being the universal language of the day, and the mail system for carrying out his plan to have the Messiah arrive and to start a church, found the Church of God, and for the apostles and for the gospel to be spread in the Roman world. It just could not have happened previously without these circumstances existing. And now God uses some more specific circumstance, another specific circumstance, which is the decree by the Roman emperor that everyone return to their home, town, or village, specific prophecies about the birth of the Messiah. These things did not happen haphazardly. God is a great God of planning and timing and purpose that we talked about last week. So now let's read how this census brings about the fulfillment of Bible prophecy. Continuing in Luke 2, verse 4, Joseph also went up from Galilee out of the city of Nazareth into Judea to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, meaning house of bread, place of bread. The bread of life is born in the place of bread, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed wife, who was with child. She is obviously heavily pregnant at this time. So a few things to consider here that are mentioned in this verse. Most of you are probably aware that when the scripture talks about going up to Jerusalem, as was mentioned here, going up from Galilee, that's not talking in our modern geographical sense where we tend to view up as going north. That was not the meaning in the way that was used in that time. It was talking about going up in elevation, because Galilee up here, the Sea of Galilee, is several hundred feet below sea level in the Jordan Rift Valley. But going up, you went up to Jerusalem, up to Judea, because Judea and Jerusalem are along this central high area of mountains and hills in the central part of Israel that basically runs north and south in this area here. So when it talks about going up to Jerusalem, they're not going north. So just erase it out of your mind. They're going up in elevation. Or in some cases, Scripture will talk about them going down and so on. But again, it's talking about going down in elevation. From Jerusalem, you basically went down, regardless of where you were going, because Jerusalem is on this high central ridge of mountains there. Called mountains there, we would call them hills here. It's not not a terribly high elevation, about 2,000 feet above sea level. So they are going from this lower altitude of Galilee up to a higher elevation there in Judea and Jerusalem. Actually, here in my notes, Jerusalem's about 2,800 feet above sea level, so approximately 3,000 feet. So another thing to consider, we know from the genealogies that we talked about earlier that both Joseph and Mary are descendants of King David. The Messiah had to be a descendant of David and various others, which is why they travel to Bethlehem for this census. They're going back to Bethlehem, David's area there. So if their ancestors, their families, are from Bethlehem, which is down here, just about 5-6 miles south of Jerusalem, why are they living, Mary and Joseph, up here in Galilee, specifically up here in Nazareth, kind of out here somewhat along the back roads, backwoods, as we talked about earlier. So why, if their families or relatives are down here, why is it that they're living 60, 70, 80 miles north up in Galilee? Again, that's not something we typically even think about to ask, because today families, people move all over the place. That was not that commonly done in that time. There are actually two historical factors that are at work here that are not mentioned in the Gospels. One is that in the first century B.C., the first century leading up to the birth of Christ, many Jews have migrated to Galilee from Judea and from Babylon, where a number of Jews still live. Why would they be moving to Galilee? Well, because they are expecting a Messiah to appear in Galilee, and they want to be there. Let's notice a prophecy that was well known to the people then, Isaiah 9, verses 1 and 2. The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea, that's referring to the Via Maris that we talked about earlier, beyond the Jordan, in Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined. And they knew that this was a prophecy of the Messiah, and religious Jews wanted to be there in Galilee when this prophecy is fulfilled. So where does Jesus grow up, and where does he begin his ministry? And how is this a fulfillment of that prophecy? Well, of course, he grows up in Nazareth. And then he moves to Capernaum, over here on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. Nazareth is in the tribal allotment of Zebulun that we just read about here, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. Where's Capernaum? Capernaum is in the land of Naphtali, part of their tribal allotment. So Jesus is fulfilling this prophecy. Of course, Jesus couldn't control where he grew up, but it was clearly fulfilling prophecy. He could control where he lived, and it's possible that this is why, one of the reasons why he chose to move to Capernaum. We'll talk about that a bit later when we get to that part of the gospel. So he is fulfilling this ancient prophecy from Isaiah many centuries earlier, that in the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, there would be a great light that people would see. And that's referring, of course, to the light of the Messiah, Jesus Christ. And people understood that. This is why Jews moved to this area at this time. This also helps us understand something else that puzzles people when they read the Gospels. This migration of religious Jews into Galilee in the century or two leading up to this time is why we see such a strong religious presence among the Jews there in Jesus Christ's ministry. When he is teaching, for instance, he continuously encounters the scribes, the Pharisees, and others. But this is not talking about Jerusalem, as we might assume. Most of this is actually taking place up here in Galilee. And why is that? Well, we talked a little bit earlier about the Jewish education system and so on. But the main point I want to emphasize again is these people are devoutly religious. They have moved to this area. They've settled in this area because they are expecting a Messiah to arrive from the prophecy that we just read. So this is a very religious people. This is why you see these deep religious discussions. And they come across to us reading them as arguments a lot of times. But actually that discussion, that kind of debate, heated debate at times, is very common among the Jewish people to this day. It was very common back then. These are the average people that Jesus is encountering, and they are quite religious. And this is why, because they, their families, their parents, their great, their grandparents, great-grandparents, moved to this area because they're expecting a Messiah. So these are very believing Jews, excited, very much anticipating the arrival of a Messiah, as we'll encounter a number of times in the Gospels. There's another reason also why Joseph in particular may not have wanted to live in the Bethlehem area. Bethlehem, again, is about 6 miles south of Jerusalem. What is Joseph's occupation? Now, before you answer carpenter, let me give you something else to think about. It's translated carpenter in our Bibles. The Greek word is tekton, T-E-K-T-O-N, T-E-K-T-O-N, which means basically a builder or a craftsman, somebody who makes things. When the King James translators saw this word, which means builder, in 400 years ago, and they're translating the Greek into English, what did people build with in England 400 years ago? They built with wood, because England is all forest. So, okay, this is a builder. Obviously, it's a carpenter. Because those translators had never been to the Holy Land. They didn't know the customs, the culture there, so on. If you go to Galilee today, or pretty much anywhere in Israel, the common building material is stone. At that time, it was certainly stone. Today, it's more concrete, which is a lot easier to work and shape and work with. Carpenters, as we understand the term today, would have been pretty few and far between because building was not commonly done with wood in that area. Yes, you would use wood for your rafters, things like that, for your doors, for shutters, for the windows, for furniture, things like that. But building in the sense of a carpenter was pretty rare because there just was not that much wood. You can go to Israel today and you'll see the types of trees that grow in Israel are generally, they're not the giant 60, 70 foot tall, nice straight trees like we have around here. They're short, they're squat, they're very twisted, they're very gnarly. You might think of olive trees, fig trees, things like that. Or the only really tall straight ones are the palm trees there, which you don't want to cut those down and use them for wood because those are valuable for dates, for food. So you don't cut these down and build houses out of them. So that's just something culturally you might find interesting, and I may go into this in more detail later on. But in my opinion, Joseph's occupation and Jesus' occupation is actually much more of a stonemason than a carpenter, as we understand the term today. However, that does not mean they did not know woodworking skills, because somebody who is a builder, regardless of what medium he works with, is going to know also how to make door frames and doors and things like that. If his job is to build houses, to do construction work, he's going to know how to work with wood to do that as well. So any questions about that? I know that's a new thought to toss out to you there, but more and more scholars are coming to realize that that's probably the case. Jesus and Joseph are actually stonemasons. And I might mention, too, I was talking with the Brits earlier about this, that from Nazareth, you'll notice on this map, about, 3-4 miles away is a town called Sepphoris. This was actually a regional, had been a capital in that part of, in that region of Galilee. And the people there rebelled, and the city was razed and destroyed. And as Jesus is growing up here in Nazareth, this town is actually being rebuilt just a few miles away, just downhill from Nazareth. And I think it's quite possible. There's actually a good book written on this called Jesus and the Forgotten City, where the author, who was a director of the digs here at Sepphoris, theorizes that Jesus and Joseph probably worked in the town of Sepphoris, because this town is being rebuilt in the 20s. This is probably where Joseph and Jesus would have done a lot of their work as Jesus is growing up. For instance, and part of his evidence for that is if you'll see references sprinkled throughout Jesus' teaching to such things as theaters and actors. For instance, Matthew 23, when he talks about the hypocrites, a hypocrite in that term was an actor, somebody who wore a mask. Where would Jesus have been familiar with actors in theaters growing up in Nazareth? Well, he wouldn't have, because Nazareth is a small village, 100, 200 people or so. Would not have had a theater there. However, Sepphoris is basically a Greco-Roman city, and we know they had a theater there, seated several thousand people. If my memory is correct, correct me if I'm wrong about that, Daniel, but I think it seated about 2,000 to 3,000 people, if my memory is correct. I've seen photos of it. And various other things. Jesus talks about kings and so on. Basileus is the Greek word that is used for that. Well, he certainly would have encountered a king in Nazareth. However, this being a regional capital up here, people would have been very familiar with the king in that region. And later, over in Tiberias is where Herod Antipas lived. So you see a lot of references to the Greco-Roman culture in Jesus' teaching. And where did he encounter that? Well, probably. I think you can make a good case that it was from working as he's growing up as a builder alongside his father there in Sepphoris and not in Nazareth. So just interesting sidelight where archaeology can add some insight into some of the details that we read about the gospel. So meanwhile, back to why Joseph and Mary are up in Galilee instead of down at Bethlehem. There's another reason why Joseph may not have wanted to live in Bethlehem. Bethlehem, a few miles south of Jerusalem. Joseph is a builder. So what is going on in the construction arena at that time? Not talking about literal arena, but what's going on? Yes, Nathan. This is in the heyday of building this temple. Slide here, illustration of it, an artist's conception of it based on the archaeology that we have today. This huge temple foundation area, the base, you might say, that still exists. The buildings themselves on top were all destroyed when the Romans took Jerusalem in 70 AD. But they've excavated all of this area down here. This is where the Western Wall or Wailing Wall is today, this area right here facing from this arch going in this direction, this whole area. They've now excavated pretty much this whole area out in here, as well as all of this down in here. And this is looking from the upper city across this little valley. This is the Tyropian Valley, and then the Kidron Valley on the other side, Mount of Olives up here to kind of orient us. So this huge construction project is going on. Herod is transforming Jerusalem into pretty much a world-class city at that time. He is also building something else closer to Bethlehem, which I've mentioned earlier, the Herodium, which is where he moved one mountain onto another mountain. And here's, originally, these two mountains were about the same size. Herod takes the top off of that one and puts it over here, and then builds this fortress palace partly in the mountain and partly on top. And this fortress palace is about 8 to 10 stories high. And again, Herod's fairly paranoid. He wants to have a place he can retreat to if need be within a few hours, a hard ride from pretty much anywhere in his kingdom. And down here is another lower palace. And actually had a swimming pool. This is the Dead Sea down in the background. So we had swimming pools, gardens, all kinds of residences for his family, servants, and all of that. And he liked this place so much that this is actually where he was buried. And they just found his tomb there something like 4 or 5 years ago. Of course, his subjects were not quite so fond of him when they did find his tomb. It had been smashed to pieces because people so detested him for such an evil, being such an evil man and such an egomaniac. So this project is going on just a few miles outside of Bethlehem as well. So if you were occupied in a building trade like Joseph, and you, where did Herod get his construction force? Well, he basically drafted them. Says, okay, you're a builder, you're strong, got a good body. Hey, you're going to work for the next 10 years on the temple or on my Herodian palace or one of my other palaces, something like that. So he would draft people. So is this a reason why Joseph and Mary move out of Herod's reach? Pretty much up 60, 70, 80 miles north up in Galilee. Well, I think you can make a good argument for that. We don't know this for sure. Again, this isn't spelled out in the Bible why they're there, but I think this is, thinking it through logically, this is probably one of the reasons they're up there. So let's see, here's one more photo. This is what the Herodium looks like today. This is part of the big pool that we saw in the earlier illustration here. He was also paranoid, so he had a little island out in the middle of that pool, which you can see right here, so that he can conduct private business there, and nobody's going to sneak up and overhear the conversations or anything like that. It's one reason why he had that built. So here's some of the columns, and this is the Herodium there. Hard to get a sense of scale because the trees, usually we judge scale by trees and things like that, but there aren't really any large trees in that area. There are a few scattered trees, olive trees, things like that. You can see a few spots of green, but it's quite impressive. You can see it for miles away. Here's an aerial view of it. Of course, the upper part of the structure has been destroyed, but here's looking down into the part that was built into the mountain. Give you some scale. Here's a parking lot with several vehicles in it. So this is quite huge. It's on my bucket list of places to see there. I haven't made it there yet, but quite impressive. So let's see. Where was I in my notes? So they are living up north in Galilee, but according to prophecy, where is the Messiah to be born? We've seen where the Messiah was to appear, in the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, but where is the Messiah to be born? There is a specific prophecy, Micah 5 and verse 2, which tells us, "But you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from old, from everlasting." So the Messiah is to be born in Bethlehem, a small town, though you are little, as it says here. Another small town, a couple of hundred people at best. So somehow Joseph and Mary have to be in Bethlehem so the Messiah can be born there to fulfill prophecy. And God uses the plan of an emperor, the Emperor Augustus, far away in Rome, to orchestrate the circumstances that will lead to the fulfillment of this prophecy. And he does that through the census that is ordered through Caesar Augustus so that the Messiah is born in exactly the right place at exactly the right time to fulfill these prophecies. God could have done it any number of ways, but he again chooses to use other circumstances to carry out his will. In this case, these very particular circumstances. Any questions about that from anyone? Okay. All right, continuing on, Luke chapter 2, verse 6. So it was that while they were there, Joseph and Mary being in Bethlehem, the days were completed for her to be delivered. And let's notice, first of all, this phrase, while they were there. Now, the common Christmas view is that Joseph and Mary arrive in Bethlehem, and it's 2 minutes till midnight, and the local Motel 6 is full. They've sold their last room. Holiday Inn's full. everything is full, and Joseph is this irresponsible lout of a father and husband, and there's no place for them, so they have to go down the street, and they find a barn, and that's where Jesus is born. Is this true? Well, again, notice the wording, while they were there. Does that indicate they're suddenly showing up at 2 minutes till midnight? No, it doesn't. While they were there, just by the very wording, indicates they are there for some time. They're not just showing up at the last minute. While they were there, they are there for some time, obviously. So they have been there for some time, and while they were there, it came time for her to give birth. So Joseph is not some irresponsible husband and father who brings his 9 months pregnant wife there on this long journey, hoping to find a place to stay at the last minute. That's just another part of the deception of Christmas. They have been there for a while. Luke doesn't tell us how long, but they have been there for some time. Verse 7, and she brought forth her firstborn son, again, firstborn, showing that there are other sons born later, as we talked about last time, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. Let's notice several things here. Firstborn son, Luke is very careful in choosing the words to convey exactly what he means. So Jesus is firstborn. There are four brothers born later on, half-brothers of Jesus. So they wrapped him in of cloth for a newborn. That's what swaddling clothes means. And they laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. And it's from this line that people get the idea of Jesus being born in a barn surrounding by the sheep and the goats and the cattle and the hay and all kinds of farm animals. But when we look at this from the standpoint of what we learn from first century culture and from archaeology, this common picture just falls completely apart. So let's look at it more closely. Let's first look at this word translated inn, as in there's no room for them in the inn. This word is the Greek word kataluma, K-A-T-A-L-U-M-A. And it means a guest room. Many of you probably grew up in houses where there was a guest room. If you had a spare bedroom there, that was the guest room. It does not mean inn as a commercial establishment renting out rooms. There is a perfectly good Greek word for that, which is pandokeion, which we see in the parable of the Good Samaritan over in Luke 10, verse 34. So he, the Good Samaritan, went to him, the man who'd been beaten and left for dead by robbers, bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and he set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn, and the Greek word is pandokeion, and took care of him. That word is used for an inn, a commercial housing establishment. Again, both accounts are from Luke. Luke knows there's a word for a commercial inn, and that's what he uses here. He does not use that word for the guest room back there, as we're reading about here in Luke 2. So yeah, actually a better way of translating this would be she laid him in a manger because there was no space. Room can have two different meanings in English. It can mean a room, like a bedroom, like a kitchen, like a den, like a man cave, or it can mean space. And what this is actually saying is there is no space for them in the guest room because the guest room is occupied. So where and what is the guest room that is being discussed here? Here's a cutaway illustration of a typical first century house of that area. Houses varied somewhat depending on the geography, but this is a typical first century house of Judea at that time. It has a main living area, and this, incidentally, is a cutaway to show what is underneath, what we might call a basement or sub-basement. So there would be a main living area, and this is where you did everything. They didn't have multiple small rooms in their houses as we do today. They didn't have separate rooms for sleeping, separate rooms for cooking, separate rooms for entertaining guests, all of this. They had one big room, and you did everything in that room. For instance, over here in a corner, you can see a bunch of mats stored in the corner that rolled up. That would have been what you slept on at night. Kind of a big bag filled with grass, husks, things like that, soft. And that would be your mattress, essentially, that you would lay down and then pull some blankets over you at night. So you just drag that out onto the floor of your living room. And your cooking is also done here. Here's a little fireplace or hearth. So they would have done the cooking right there. You would have had certain amount of storage there. Here's a wooden case for storage for goods and so on. You would have had your cooking utensils there. Incidentally, in this, you see these openings in the wall here. They found some structures where actually that's where you stored your grain. It would be a hollow wall, and essentially you'd have bins built into the wall. You'd pour your grain in there, and that would store it there, protect it from mice and rats and things like that. So where's the guest room? Well, notice behind this wall is another small room off to the side. Normally, this would have been used as what we would use as a storeroom. That's where we'd put our junk, put our stuff that we're not using. But that was the guest room in that time. Hospitality was very, very important to people in that period. That's another theme that shows up a number of times in the Gospels. So you always had a guest room. I mean, unless you were really, really poor, you had a guest room there for people who might show up at the last minute needing a place to stay. And this tradition of hospitality goes all the way back to Abraham and Sarah. You might remember again when the angels appear before them. What's the first thing Abraham does? He offers to cook them a meal, to kill a goat for them, to bake them bread, give them a good meal. That tradition of hospitality is very common in that culture. And vestiges of that continue to this day. So this is your upper room and your guest room. The guest room would not have been huge. It would have been small, just enough room for one or two people to lay their mat down and sleep on the floor. Probably about the size of a walk-in closet, something like that. So what is the real story that's going on here? Well, Joseph and Mary go to their ancestral home, Bethlehem. It's their family home, so no doubt they have relatives who are still living there, cousins, brothers, aunts, uncles, that sort of thing. And they go because they have to register for the census. But as we talked about earlier, this also coincides with the fall holy days. And at the fall holy days, a million or more people come to Jerusalem. And Jerusalem can't absorb that many people, so people are camped out on the hills all around Jerusalem. They're extending way out into the suburbs, and Bethlehem is kind of a suburb of Jerusalem. So every room in Bethlehem is also going to be filled with people coming for the Feast of Tabernacles, as we talked about the dating last week there. So because of this, this is probably why there is no space in the guest room, because some other family members are already staying there in the guest room. Makes perfect sense when you understand the timing and the culture and the way the houses were constructed and all of this. So normally, Joseph and Mary would have stayed in the kataluma, the guest room there. But there isn't enough space for Joseph and Mary and a newborn baby for all three of them to fit in the kataluma, or maybe some other relatives with a larger family are already in the kataluma. We don't know, no details given. So what did they do, and how does Jesus end up as a newborn being put in a manger? What's up with that? Let's take another look at this illustration, and let's ask a question for you. Other than your own family, if you're a first century family living in Judea, what is your most valuable possession? Yes, Julia. Your livestock, very good, very good. Shows you're thinking about that. Yes, your animals, your livestock, your sheep, your goats, maybe an ox. Most families couldn't afford an ox or a donkey. That was your tractor, your transportation at that time. But your livestock, your animals. If your animals are your most valuable possession, are you going to leave them outside at night? Where wolves, two-legged or four-legged, or jackals, or lions, or animals like that, wild dogs, can come and attack and kill your animals. You lose your goat, you've lost your source of milk for your kids, for your family. From the goat milk, you also get your cheese, things like that. For sheep, you've lost your source of wool for clothing. Or that kind of thing. So your animals were very, very valuable possessions. So what did you do with them? Well, essentially, you locked them up in the basement. And that is what is shown here. To this day, you'll find old houses. I'll actually show you a photo of one here in a few minutes. Where in the basement is, technically it's not a basement. A lot of these houses would have been built over a shallow cave or something. And by shallow cave, I'm talking about something maybe half the size of this stage, not a cave that goes back hundreds of feet or anything like that. But the limestone of that area was very conducive for shallow caves and fairly soft. You could carve out basements and things like that. So there would be a room underneath, or in some cases a central courtyard of the house, where you would keep your animals at night, to keep them safe, to keep them from being stolen, to keep them from being killed by a wild animal or something like that. And in this particular house, you can see it's got kind of a sub-basement with some openings, and they would bring in the animals there at night. And here's the front door of the house. But that would protect your animals. It would also, the body heat of the animals would help keep your house warm at night, because winter nights can get pretty chilly there at that time of year. This sounds really, really odd to us to keep our livestock in our house at night. And again, we're not talking about 20, 30 animals. The average person may have 3, 4, 5 sheep and goats, and that's it. That is the bulk of your wealth, those animals. But we do find this custom of keeping animals in the house referred to in Scripture. Here's one you might write down, 1 Samuel 28:24. Now the woman had a fatted calf in the house. She's raised this calf for slaughter, and she doesn't want anything to happen to it before it's slaughtered for meat. Another one, Judges, the tragic story of Jephthah. In Judges 11, verses 30 and 31, Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will indeed deliver the people of Ammon into my hands, then it will be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I shall return in peace from the people of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering." Notice he says, whatever comes out of the door, not whoever. He wasn't expecting, as the story turns out, his daughter to run out. He was expecting one of his animals to come out, and that he would then offer that as an offering. So here's two references to this practice of keeping animals in the house. They were very valuable. So what is being described here is there's not enough room in the cataluma, in the guest room for other guests, for Joseph and Mary. So they move down to this lower level where the animals are kept. And here's a photograph that I mentioned earlier. This is an actual house in that area, and this is the area underneath the house where the animals are kept. And you can actually see a manger here, or we would call it a feed trough or a watering trough. In a feed trough, you would have hay, you would have straw there for the animals to eat, which would make a nice soft bed for a newborn baby in a situation like that. So why are they there? Well, probably because the cataluma, the guest room, is occupied. Maybe they need more space down there for the birth of the baby, because there's going to be probably a midwife, some relatives there to help with the delivery. maybe depending on the size, the animals are probably moved out while she's delivering the baby. I might mention too, obviously, the animals are cleaned up after in the morning after they've spent the night in the basement, because animals do what animals do. So you clean it up, clean out the remains, the waste, and so on. Incidentally, animal waste was a common cooking fuel source. They would take the animal solid waste, they would take it outside, let it dry, and burn it for fuel. If any of you have read about our early pioneers crossing the Great Plains, the people who lived in sod houses, they didn't have wood there to burn for fuel. What did they use? They used cow patties and buffalo patties for fuel, and that was done in ancient times in the Middle East as well. So the manger probably is not a typical wooden box like you see in all the Christmas cards, but was likely made out of stone, as the example shown here. Probably also lined with plaster, particularly if it's a watering trough, would be lined with plaster so it's watertight there. So this would have made a nice makeshift cradle for the newborn baby, Jesus Christ, to be born in. So bottom line here, Jesus is not born in a barn because a local Motel 6 is full. Instead, they are staying in somebody's home, probably a relative's. And since both of them are descendants of David, and because the guest room, there's no room in that, they temporarily move down to the area where the animals are kept overnight. And that is the real story, and it's quite different from the traditional Christmas story of them being born in a barn, Joseph being an irresponsible husband and father, and so on. So this is just a total myth when we really understand what is going on. Yes, Charlie. Yeah.
So it's safe to say they're in the basement with the animals of that house.
Well, where the animals would have been kept, whether the animals were there at that moment, we don't know. No doubt somebody would have been watching the animals. It wouldn't have just let the animals loose outside. But probably the animals are moved aside just because there's probably at least 3-4 women there assisting Mary with the birth and helping her out there. But yeah, eventually after a day or two, the animals would have been brought back into that area. So nice and clear. Any questions about that? Yes, Kayla, yeah. Good question for the benefit of the recording. Kayla's question is how many words are incorrectly translated and why? Actually, most of the translation is quite good. One of the big weaknesses of translation is like the example I mentioned earlier with tecton, carpenter. The King James translators were working with a fairly limited number of manuscripts, probably the best manuscripts as we understand them, but that was 400 years ago. Many other manuscripts have been found since then, both of the scriptures and of other contemporary writings. And by that I mean we now have access to many other Greek manuscripts from 1st and 2nd century. We can have a better idea of the range of meanings of particular words like that. Some of it was just sheer bias, like the example in Acts where the King James translators translate Pascha, which means Passover, as Easter. Doesn't remotely mean or have anything to do with Easter. It's just a deliberate mistranslation. There are cases like that where they are influenced by their bias, because there are cases in the Trinity where they refer to the Holy Ghost, as it was originally, Holy Spirit, as a he and so on. Why did they do that? Well, for 1,000 years, they have believed in the Trinity. So when they read those words, they automatically view them through the lens of a Trinity. I'm not saying that's the case with Cataluma here. But, they're just words that, yeah, we don't know why they translated them that way, just that they did, and we try to get the record straight. Now, incidentally, I've read several articles from Bible translators this is where I got the source for this information. There are Bible translators that acknowledge this is exactly what it means, a guest room. But now translators won't translate it correctly as a guest room because the traditions of Christmas are so ingrained that they know people won't buy the Bible if it is properly. They won't buy a new translation if it doesn't contain the stories that they really like and love. So good question. Yes, Andrew, yeah.
Is any of this supposed to be fulfilling prophecy or an example of like where he's born, having been born in a manger?
Right.
Is there prophecy to it, or is there just a significance of like, you know, it was not he was born in some big thing in some flashy way?
Yes and no. Not a specific prophecy, but in general, yes. And we'll touch on that a little bit later into the next hour. Well, yeah, good question. Okay, let's take our break.